Yeah, hello, I'm Paul Smith, a clothes designer, but more recently a designer of other things, and we're in my studio in London's Covent Garden. My studio's in an old building that was an old warehouse in London's Covent Garden, which I'm sure you all know was originally a fruit and vegetable market, where every building was full of fruit and vegetables. And this building was built in 1900, so it's a red brick building. I've been here since 2000, so 10 years. When I moved here, I moved my studio. I was in, so we hired about 9 buildings around the area, and it was pretty difficult to keep track of everything, but so now we're all, there's 180 of us in this one building, which is great. So I've got all my assistant designers and marketing and sales, everything. Before, I was in a little studio above one of my shops in Floral Street in Covent Garden, which was in a little attic, and it was absolutely crammed full of books and objects and kitsch things and beautiful things and references of things I could use for ideas. And in October 2000, I knew I'd got to move to this new building, and I looked at the room and I thought, there's no way I can move any of this stuff out. So it's there still, full of beautiful, amazing, strange and crazy things. And it was up a spiral staircase, how I used to get into it. And I floorboarded across the top of the spiral staircase, so there's a little space capsule in the middle of Covent Garden. I moved in there in 82 until 2000, so it's just there, and I've not been back since. So I arrived in my studio here, which is two rooms, and on the top floor of the building, and it was completely empty, and I felt absolutely bereaved and in shock for quite a long time, but very, very quickly, suddenly things started arriving, things from fans around the world, which the post bag every day is absolutely astounding, amazing, with objects, gifts, kitsch things, funny things, amazing, silly, stupid things arrive all the time. Lots of books. I think I'm probably surrounded by about 10,000 books, CDs, objects. I find it really useful as a point of reference when I'm... I always have my design meetings around the big table where we're sitting at now, which has got 8 chairs around it. And it's just a big rosewood table where I attempt to keep it clear, but it's not always that easy. And then when I have the designers come up, we just talk through the various collections, because there's 26 collections of clothes and accessories designed a year from this building. And often I just lean back in my chair and grab a book and I say, I mean the colours like this, or I love the work of this graphic designer and isn't it so abstract, or something. So it's a room that really works as a source of inspiration, and more recently has helped me with the various new projects I've been doing. One unknown fan has been sending me things for, I'm not sure quite how long it is, I think it's between 15 and 20 years, and he or she sends things. We know they come from America, it's always the same handwriting. There's been a bicycle saddle, a piece of wood, a fishing rod, a toboggan, a plastic apple, some incredible Hulk hands, and just many, many things. Just step ladders, a torso. The key point about them is, it's an unknown person. But the key point is absolutely mind-blowing, which is the fact that they always arrive as they are, never in a box, and they've got the actual address written on the actual object, even a plastic green apple or a piece of wood, and the stamps are actually put onto the actual object, and they arrive. And for me, I mean, you know, maybe a lot of your listeners and myself are are lovers of the art world and creativity, but, you know, you do sometimes put a question mark over whether things are art or not, especially with the, you know, the technology that has existed today. But when I see these things come through the post, I think, in a way, it's more art than a lot of art that exists in the world. When we just get this, I mean, there's a piece that we can see in the corner of my office from where I'm sitting, is a branch of a tree with, you know, Paul Smith and the address on it, and it's just covered in stamps, and often the stamps relate to the object. So I got a water ski sent recently, and the stamps were about water skiing, and then this piece of wood has got vegetation stamps on it, you know, like leaves and vegetables and things. So whoever's doing it, it's really, really thought through, and so quite delightful, and feel very... I sort of don't want to know who it is that sent them, because the mystery is better than knowing, you know. I mean, I've always found it easy for inspiration personally, but I seem to have been blessed with these sort of eyes that see rather than just look. And I think a lot of people travel the world but don't really see anything. They're concerned about their flight or their schedule or something, and they don't really use their eyes so much, which is fair enough in many, many industries, but in the creative industry, obviously, it's all there if you want it. So if you can train yourself to look up, look out, and not spend your time texting or with your head in your computer, I think that's a good bit of advice, I would say. So you could be. You can be walking down the street and you can see some graffiti on a wall, and you like the fact that it's graffiti on a red brick wall, or you can look at some stained glass in the end of a church and think that that would make a great piece of knitwear, or you can go to see an art exhibition and it could be the deep, rich colours of a painting, or it could be the bright, optimistic colours of, let's say, a Matisse painting. So... It's all there if you want it. Often I go to street markets as well, which looking for. Sometimes I buy clothes because they've got an interesting pocket, or they've got a nice shaped lapel, or the way it's made is very interesting. Or I might buy an old dress because I like the print, which we'd never copy but would use as inspiration. It might be an old book, a comic, an old newspaper, a map. So an old map could be the inspiration for a print on a, you know, piece of luggage, which is obviously related to travel. So it's a matter of thinking very laterally and just not going down the obvious route, especially in design, because as we all know, with design, it's about newness. And although you can have a product which lasts for many, many years, in order to keep your business going, you need to have new ideas all the time. And things are always changing. So not just... trends, but technology as well. So especially in fashion, you've got to be 100% or stop. Yeah, I've been asked over the last 25 years, to be honest, I've been asked to do many, many things, and I think one of my good points has been learning to say no to a lot of things. And you know, over the years, well, in fact, over this last year, I think I could have designed about 5 phones and 2 cars and a couple of hotels. And you know, you get off of the projects and you really think, well, is this for me? Is this something I genuinely feel I could do well? And I genuinely think I want to do it? So saying no to many things has been really important. But when the boss of the Danish company called Stelton wrote a letter to me saying, would I consider being involved in revitalizing the famous cylinder line that was designed by the designer Arne Jacobsen, I was flattered and shocked and nervous because I'm not sure whether all your listeners know the work of Arne Jacobsen, but you know, he was one of my heroes, a real pure designer, very, very disciplined, unlike me, who tends to be all over the place. And the cylinder line is a stainless steel line of coffee pots, teapots, milk jugs, etc., which have been around for many, many years. And in fact, it's the 50th anniversary of this product. And they asked me if I could do something with it. And the first thing was, well, what can you do with something that is so perfect? And so I really thought I couldn't do anything with it. But then when I realised that one of the reasons why they were attracted to talking to me was because of my use of colour, and because I'm quite well known for being brave with colour, even for clothes for men. I don't mean red suits, but, you know, interesting stripes or a colourful lining in a jacket or something like that. So the way I approached it in the end was... the stainless steel range always had a very simple black handle, so I just thought, well, just do something with the handle, you know. And so what I've done is I've just selected 12 colours that sort of fit into three categories: pastels, sophisticated. Muted colours, and then brights, and so there's 12 colours where I've kept everything the same as it was, but just the handles have become a different colour. And then some of the other products, which have got like a little lid on them, like a sugar bowl or something, we've just done the lid in colour. And then in addition to that, I've just done a series of bowls which are called DOT, that come in three sizes, and it's just literally a dot, a round bowl with a little concave surface, and the concave surface has colours. And I originally gave them quite a lot of colours because I'm so used to working with colour. So I gave them, I think it was 54 colours, saying that let's put them in the same categories as the handles, so pastels, brights, mid colours. But these are some for you to select from, providing you do the sort of equal amount of the three categories. And they've chosen all 54 colours that I sent them. So I thought, oh, you must be mad. You know, 54 colours, that's going to be so complicated for people to stock or choose. And they said, no, it's brilliant because you've done, you know, from a dark purple through to a very, very pale mauve, and you've done from a dark, you know, almost Yves Klein, well, a navy blue, then into Yves Klein blue, then to sky blue. And so it was pretty amazing. But that's what's happened. And one of the things I was nervous about was a bit of a backlash on, you know, somebody called Paul Smith, who's a fashion designer, you know, tinkering with something which is so iconic. And touch wood, so far, I'm touching wood now, so far everybody's been very complimentary, so fingers crossed that that's the way it's going to continue. I became a designer literally by accident, because as a young teenager I wanted to be a racing cyclist. And so from the age of 11, which is when my father bought me a racing bike, up until the age of 17, I was passionate about cycling. So I suppose about the age of 12, I started to not just cycle around near my home, but joined the local cycle club, and we started to go out on what they call club runs, you know, at the weekend. But then eventually started to race as a schoolboy, and then progressed to a junior, and then sadly one day I had a bad crash which landed me in hospital with lots of broken bones for several months. And when I came out of hospital, I arranged to meet some of the people that I'd met in hospital, a couple of the guys that would also had accidents, like a motorbike accident or a car accident. And one of them said, why don't we just meet at this particular pub, and by chance it was a pub that where all the art students used to go, and from the local art college, which is now a university, but you know it was an art college then. And you know, I slowly, after visiting a few times, getting to know a few of the other people that were drinking there and socialising there, and it was I'm a graphic design student at the Trent Art College. I'm an architecture student, and like suddenly this world was opening up to me, and I thought, wow, what an interesting world, and if only you could make a living, you know, just doing something like that. And then eventually one of the girls that was there was opening her a little clothes shop with the help of her father, was financing her, and she was going to make and design and make the clothes. But she said to me, you know, would you help me sort of start the shop? Because I don't really know about shops or anything. And I didn't either, but I said, yes, absolutely. And leapt at the opportunity. And so suddenly that was quite a nice growing up period, because I was 18 and suddenly I was dealing with the real estate agents and then something called a solicitor, you know, with regard to something called a lease, you know, and all stuff I'd never done before. And so suddenly you were like delving into this brand new world, which was very practical on one side. But then as soon as the shop was open, I ended up running the shop for her, and I decorated the windows, and then eventually we started to sell just not clothes that she was designing, but men's clothes that we were buying in from other people. And then eventually one day this lady came in, at my 21st birthday party, a lot of the students from the art college came, and one of the ladies that was there was one of the teachers who came up from London 2 days a week, and she'd turned out that she was a trained fashion designer from the Royal College of Art, and she'd been there at the same time as some of the famous designers like Ozzie Clarke and artist Peter Blade, David Hockney and things like that. And we met and eventually started to get to know each other, fell in love, and she came to Nottingham to live with me. And she then encouraged me to start my own little shop. After 3 years, she was saying, you know, you've got so many ideas and so much energy, why don't you consider your own little shop? And I saved up some money by working on my free day for 3 years and opened this. Well, I called it a shop. It was a 12-foot square room down a little back alleyway. But the key thing was that Monday through to Thursday, I still continued to do masses of other jobs. I left the boutique where I was working, as it was called, boutique, and I was a freelance stylist, and I did all sorts of jobs. I mean, helping people make clothes, and I called it learning by doing it. But also I was earning money. And then on Friday and Saturday, I opened my little room, which was full of things that really nobody wanted. But eventually, they were intrigued by them, and so that was the start of getting my own little shop. And then slowly Pauline at home taught me about how to pattern cut, how to make clothes, and how to use my eyes. And eventually, after 2 or 3 years, we started a very tiny little collection, which consisted of about 2 shirts and 2 jackets and 2 pairs of trousers, and that was the first Paul Smith collection. And then since then, it's just been a nice, gradual, slow process where we've never really borrowed money. We've always lived within our means, and we just built the business gently and slowly. And I think that's why it's continued to do well, because it's very solid and it's real. It's not a label that has been created by a marketing team. It's actually got a strong foundation. There's a character to the name and the brand. I mean, there's, especially with fast fashion now, things are imitated so quickly, and there's some brilliant clothes out there at very reasonable prices. So as a runway or catwalk designer, then it's not good enough just to be good at clothes. I think you've got to have something that surrounds your name or your business. And then probably finally, just the individuality of all the shops, whereas many of the big companies around the world have just literally rolled out the similar or same looking shop around the world, has been a killer of main streets in Paris, Milan and wherever, where unfortunately they all look the same now. But where we, wherever we open shops, they're normally never on the main street. They're normally sort of tucked in a little interesting area near a main street, often in something like, we have a shop in a house and we have a shop in a, well, three shops in houses actually, one in Kyoto, one in my hometown of Nottingham and one in London. So we've always tried to go for individuality and character, and I think people appreciate that, because wherever they go to a Paul Smith shop, they never know what they're going to find, and there's always some sort of intrigue with, you know, how the shop look.